Welcome to the meeting. Chuck Anders was going to lead off with some points, but he's gathering himself for the moment. We were going to introduce ourselves briefly as members of the DCDEP panel. We have a number of new members today as well that are attending this meeting for the first time that I'll be introducing, and I should do that now. Want to first acknowledge that Will Almas has recently left the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel, and we want to thank him for his years of service and his contributions, which have included participating in a national committee for long-term storage and proposals that have gone to Congress in the last 6 months. Linda Vanasoop is a recent member, and I would like to let her introduce herself.
Hello, can you hear me? All right. Hi, I'm Linda Vanasoop. I'm an emeritus professor from Cal Poly in materials engineering and a resident of San Luis for 30-some years. I'm glad to be here, and I hope to be of service and a good listener. I guess that's about it.
Also, I should recognize that Tom Jones, who's long participated in our meetings, has been officially has become a ex officio member of the panel. He is not with us today with business in Washington, D.C.
I'm here, Bruce.
Oh, you're here?
Oh. Yeah, and I'm a panel member, not ex officio. I'm PG&E's representative. I can see you.
Yeah. Yeah, Tom is watching us. So I'm sorry, I understood you weren't able to make it. And then Dave Houghton is another new member, and I'd like to turn it over to him to introduce himself.
Hi, my name is Dave Houghton. I am a practicing engineer, registered civil and mechanical. I teach about half-time at Cal Poly in the civil engineering department, and resident of San Luis Obispo, and definitely an interested party. I'll leave it at that for now.
Susan Strachan is also an ex officio member and is unable to attend in person today, but she's attending by Zoom. She is a representative with the County Building and Planning Department and has been a real contribution to the panel over the last couple of months. So she is attending by Zoom this evening. Have I missed anyone? I don't believe I have. Chuck, do you want to cover the points you were going to cover previously?
Thank you, Bruce, for starting the meeting. My name is Chuck Anders. I'm the facilitator of the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel. And this is the 28th meeting of the engagement panel since its inception in May of 2018. This is an in-person and webinar format meeting. So we have folks here in person, and we also have people participating via Zoom. I want to remind everybody that the agenda, the presentations, and the resource documents are available at the panel's website, which is DiabloCanyonPanel.org. And that's all I have, Bruce. We can turn it over for the safety briefing. Dylan, you want to give a safety orientation?
Good evening, everybody. Thank you for being here. My name is Dylan George with the Diablo Canyon Public Policy Team. A quick safety overview. First of all, restrooms right there through that door. The emergency exit is going to be right through this door. That's where the stairs are, so in case the elevators are inoperable. We have with us today Mitch Stump from the Diablo Canyon Fire Department. He'll be here for medical standby, any medical emergencies. We have Officer Leyva from Atascadero PD here to protect us. And I think that just about covers the safety moment. So thanks for being here.
Thank you. So we turn it over now to Tom Jones presenting on the repurposing of PG&E's Parcel P facilities. several key points that I should mention as Tom takes over here is that a number of things have transpired in the last year. There have been three other meetings that addressed repurposing of Parcel P assets, and those occurred in two occurred in 2018 and one in 2021. As many already know, in the last year, SB 846 has put continued operation of Diablo Canyon front and center. And there are a number of other concurrent activities. Probably most importantly is the offshore leases that have been sold on for about $700 million worth of offshore wind leaseholds and continued planning for offshore wind, which does create some competition for transmission capacity assets. PG&E has also applied for a 20-year extension of their operating license, which is in excess of the 5-year extension that the state of California had originally sought, but that's what they consider to be standard procedure with the NRC. Tom, do you want to take it from here?
Thanks, Bruce, for that introduction. So good evening, everyone. I'm Tom Jones. I'm the Senior Director of Regulatory, Environmental, and Repurposing for Pacific Gas and Electric Company for our nuclear assets, including Diablo Canyon. And our team with you tonight also supports Humboldt Bay and many of those activities. If we can go to the first slide, please. I'm going to orient folks on the lands and where Parcel P is. Thank you. So Parcel P is about in the center. There's an arrow going to it, and it's just to the right of the north arrow on the map, right off the Pacific Ocean. It's nearly in the middle of the properties that PG&E either has control of or ownership of. So if you're familiar with Avila Beach, from the front gate, it's very near the Port St. Louis Harbor District facilities. We either lease or control those properties all the way up to Montana Dural State Park. About in the center is Parcel P. That's got different zoning, which is very important for repurposing. And I know Ms. Strachan will talk about that a little bit later tonight, but it's zoned public facility. So it's very permissive for things like institutions, think college campus, think power plants, things like that that generally serve the public. And so that's the about 750 acres in that area. It's more than just Parcel P, but we shorthand it for Parcel P because there's another parcel to the north where a portion of it is in our Nuclear Regulatory Commission license. So if we go to the next slide, we'll zoom in on Parcel P, shorthand, and you'll see a red outline. So if we can go to the next slide, slide two, please.
We have a little technical issue, so give us one moment, please.
There it is. Thank you. So this is an area that's in PG&E's licensed boundary for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So ultimately, Diablo Canyon will decommission. We don't know when that is now. But the projects and things we're looking for will happen in this area. And so if we can go to the next slide, I'll talk about some of the jurisdictions. And so it's the same image, but you'll see some shading. That's the area where the NRC, it's like a diagonal pinstripe. That's the area where the NRC has exclusive jurisdiction for nuclear and safety issues. You'll see a yellow line bifurcating that red section, and that's the coastal zone. So then we have two different jurisdictional matters there. The area just to the right and above that yellow zone, that's the exclusive jurisdiction of the County of San Luis Obispo. So they have all the rights for any permitting activities that are discretionary in that area. And then the area to the left that's green, that's in both San Luis Obispo County's local coastal program, which is approved by the Coastal Commission, but it's subject to appeal to the Coastal Commission. And then there are areas, if you look at the marina area in the lower left around the red outline, those are areas called original jurisdiction, where the California Coastal Commission has exclusive jurisdiction for building permits, but we're also the tenant in those areas of the California State Lands Commission. So a lot of moving parts. But one of the key takeaways is PG&E can't act unilaterally for what's going to happen on these areas. And a lot of the topics for decommissioning require discretionary approvals from these various regulators at different periods of time. And if we can go to the next slide, really setting up for tonight, this is an image from the north looking south, and we chose this image for a couple of reasons. One, when it comes to offshore wind, there's a number of discussions that are going on, including could the Diablo Marina or port, which is in the upper right corner here, serve as some sort of support facility for those efforts? And then on the lower left of the image, what you see are the two transmission yards. One's 500 kV, 500 kilovolts, and the other is a 230 kV yard. So the question becomes, will that make sense or not for an interconnection agreement? There is no specific project yet, and you're going to hear more for CAISO tonight about what things could look like in the region should offshore wind move ahead. The last thing I'll tell you is, with a little bit of the uncertainty now about how long the power plant will continue to operate, we've started talking to some interested parties about co-use. There's nothing necessarily that precludes us from having some people join some of the facilities while we're still operating. So when we think about that, think of it as a warm handoff or cooperation of some facilities. There's been nothing formal. If there are assets that are encumbered, we'd have to go to the Public Utilities Commission for approval. But those conversations have shifted from when you leave the facility to when you're there, could we still use them? So we're very flexible in our approach to that. We're not trying to close down opportunities, but keep them open. And the last thing, and the panel gets a lot of credit for this, is one of our biggest repurposing considerations is to repurpose the marina and the breakwater. And that saves customers about $400 million, and it gives California a new public harbor. Rather than if we remove it, those assets would actually also have to go to Arizona. And so that's quite costly. That results in about an additional 32,000 truck trips over the course of several years through Avila. We think that's not a desired outcome, and the EIR contemplates repurposing as well, so I know Mr. Strachan can talk about that. But wanted to give you the lay of the land. We've had a couple of repurposing conversations before, including several years ago at Atascadero City Hall, so it's a nice coincidence. But all this information is available online. And what's not listed tonight is there's also a bona fide way for parties to express interest and then go through due diligence process. So if anyone watching today or rebroadcasting, there is an email address we'll put up later on about how folks can make inquiry. And with that, Bruce, I'll hand it back to you.
Thank you, Tom. If you don't mind, I wanted to ask, you had mentioned that you thought your PG&E could be flexible about the transition in terms of facilitating offshore wind. Are you suggesting that you think that the Cove could be used as a support for offshore wind simultaneous to continued operation, and that other infrastructure could also fall into that category?
It could. It depends on the size of the vessel they'd like to use. Our harbor is about 30, 32 feet deep. Some of the vessels they use for crew and maintenance are larger than what our harbor can accommodate, but there are also smaller chase vehicles and more frequent vessels that would go out to the station should a project come online. So we're very willing to do that. We've also discussed, could there be marine research activities with the CSU system, both Cal Poly and broader, and the CSU system's staff from Long Beach that look at their capital planning resources have toured the facility with that of one of the many possibilities in mind.
Thank you. Appreciate that feedback.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, Tom. Kara, you have a question.
I do. Can you hear me okay? Tom, thank you for your presentation. I understand in talking to some of the offshore wind leaseholders that in addition to tying in to the grid by way of those KV yards, they might also need on land like support structures for that. And they could be as large as 8 to 10 acres. And if there's three leaseholders, that could be, you know, as many as 30 acres. I'm wondering, do you think that that sort of land use could be accommodated on Parcel P while Diablo is still running, or how does that look to you?
We need to see a footprint. So is it possible? Yes. The zoning is there. The LCP supports it. But we haven't seen a design of any project yet. They're still very, very early in those stages. And we've also seen differing amounts of the onshore, the terrestrial requirements for when offshore wind makes landing. I think a speaker later, Jeff, might be able to touch on some of those things from CAISO today. So it's a qualified possible answer, right? We don't know the project or the requirements yet and how that would interact or not with both decommissioning plans and operational plans.
Okay, thank you. One follow-up question. So there's 6 gigawatts available transmission capacity at Diablo. And I think Diablo Canyon uses about 2.2, which leaves about 3.8 free. How do you see Diablo's operations working with offshore wind when I understand the full build-out of offshore wind is somewhere around 6 gigawatts? Or how would you envision that those two operations coexisting, if at all?
It's a very hypothetical question, and that build-out will take a significant amount of time. I don't know how to phase it yet because, again, there's no project to look at. But, again, I think our expert speaker from CAISO might have some answers for that as well this evening. Very hypothetical at this point. No answers on the project, the size, or how they intend to make interconnection.
I believe Dave Houghton has a question.
Thank you.
Tom. So,
thank you. Sir, Dave, Michael was next, and then you. Raise your hand, and then we'll call the panelists in the order their comments. Turn your mic on, Michael.
The button needs to be up.
How about that?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. The issue in Morro Bay right now concerns the nature of the battery farm that's being discussed there. Does that something like that fit into the possible reuse in Parcel P?
It certainly can. The zoning's there. And we submitted 11 scenarios as part of our environmental impact report and coastal development application. And one of those scenarios has an illustration that depicts energy storage, an energy storage facility. I think it's scenario 3. And what you see is essentially the parking lots that are already level converted to large battery fields. And we show also taking advantage of the port to bring them in, things like that. So that is one of the scenarios that we've just hypothetically considered, and it would be permissible with the zoning and could take advantage of some of the infrastructure that's at the location.
Thank you, Michael. Tom. Dave, one last question for Tom before we move on.
Yeah, Tom, do you think that security considerations could be handled with co-use?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Do you think that security considerations, which are significant out there, could be handled with a co-use scenario where you had other operators on site doing things, having to move through, et cetera?
Certainly and easily. In fact, there is another offshore wind terminal on the East Coast that's co-located with a nuclear facility, so we wouldn't be breaking any new ground in how a nuclear power plant and port activities coexist. And the second part is we give a great advantage to them because it's a secure facility where we can control access. And we badge folks, and we do co-use right now. You might not think of it, but we have several cattle operations out on the ranches, and those ranchers have badges so that they can go through our front gate. Now, they have different levels of access, but that's something we would do. And when we grant those badges, those employees of the other company not only would be subject to that employee's background check, but ours.
Great. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Dave. Linda, do you have a quick question?
Yeah. Are you finished? Is Tom finished with his presentation now?
Yes.
Oh, I thought that we were going to talk a little bit about what are the plans of PG&E, because you've applied for a 20-year license extension, and there isn't enough space on the current slab to accommodate 20 years, or you're planning on keeping the waste in the pools for 20 years, is that right? And also, that was one question. Another question is, I know that you applied for a 20-year license extension, but I'd like you to, if you would, please disabuse the public of a meme that's going around now, which is that you can only apply for a 20-year license extension. According to NRC rules, you can apply for as long as an extension as you desire, given it has a couple of it will be issued for a fixed period of time, which is the sum of the additional amount of time beyond the expiration of the operating license or combined license, not to exceed 20 years, that is requested in a renewal application, plus the remaining number of years on the operating license or combined license currently in effect. People in this community believe that you have to apply for a 20-year license. That is not true. Number two, what about the waste? I thought we were talking about that tonight.
Thank you, Linda. No, that actually is somewhat off topic as it relates to repurposing of Parcel P. But, Tom, maybe you can quickly respond to Linda's question, and then we can move on.
Yeah, so SB 846 required the utility to give a report on the storage capacities at Diablo Canyon. There's over 60 years of capacity with the built environment at the facility today, 40 years of operation on the isthmus, and exceeding 20 years in the pools. We don't know how long we'll ultimately run for because we're running at the behest of the state to address energy shortage issues. So we have applied for a 20-year license. That's all the NRC has ever granted. You accurately quote the regulatory framework. It says up to 20, but all license renewals in the United States, and there's been over 30 of them, are for 20 years. The regulator has never evaluated one shorter. They have granted licenses for 20, and people haven't operated that duration, like Oyster Creek. They applied for 20. They operated approximately 10 years in their license extension period. So all the environmental and safety analysis will look at what is required for 20 years. The state, however, controls how long we operate with three mechanisms. The state is in charge of the once-through cooling policy through the regional and state water boards. The state is in charge of the power of the purse strings. We're a regulated utility. And the state is in charge of whether or not we enjoy a lease in the people's waters off the coastline where our intake and discharge structures are. So SB 846 calls for 5 years. We talked to policy leaders at several agencies and said, if you need us for 5 years in a day, we can't do it for you. We can apply for 20, and you can still use those three control mechanisms to inform how long the power plant operates to meet the energy needs of California. So that's why we've applied for 20, and right now the enacting legislation and findings by agencies is for 5 years.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Linda. Let's move on to our next topic. And that is the Parcel P reuse concepts identified in the draft environmental impact report for Diablo decommissioning that was prepared by San Luis Obispo County. And our speaker tonight is Susan Strachan. Susan is an ex officio member of the panel. And this is her first meeting as an ex officio member. She's also planning division manager for environmental at the San Luis County Department of Planning and Building. And as I mentioned, Susan was in charge of the preparation of the draft environmental impact statement or report. So, Susan, are you available online?
I am ready to go.
Go for it.
Okay, thank you. If I could get the next slide, please. So I'm going to talk a little bit tonight about something that we included in the environmental impact report. We have a section which is called Potential Reuse Concepts, and this is for Parcel P. Again, it's in our draft decommissioning EIR, which was issued in July 2023. And it was a section that we included for informational purposes only, evaluating just some concepts of what could happen or could be done at the site at Parcel P. There was no analysis of the concepts. There's no decision-making that will be made on the concepts. It was just provided for informational purposes. Next slide, please. So the information was developed, or the concepts were developed, based on information from several different sources. We had took information from the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel Strategic Plan. Friends of Diablo Canyon Lands had a document referred to as a conservation framework. Information came from there. PG&E, I think Tom had mentioned, had put together some repurposing and reuse concepts, and you'll see some figures from that in just a bit. REACH, which is the organization that's our county's economic development partner, they had several activities from which we drew ideas on the concepts. And then lastly, we took information from the scoping process for the environmental impact report. Next slide. So the draft EIR described 8 potential reuse concepts, and they're listed here. And what I'm going to do is just go through each one. And again, I just have to reiterate that these were just concepts, just provided for information. Next slide. Okay, so the first one is referred to as a clean tech innovation park. And what I want to point out on the slide is up at the top corner, or at the top of the slide, where you see the lines, the transmission lines basically leaving the site, and the two blue pools. Transmission lines are coming from PG&E's 500 kV switchyard. There's other lines coming from the 230 kV switchyard. That's going to be post-decommissioning the PG&E owner-controlled area. So, again, the two switchyards are there, the dry cast storage is there, the ISFACI, and that area will remain under PG&E controlled. So when we're talking about the concepts, we're talking about the colored areas, the different colored areas within the 750-acre site, which is identified in red. So under the mixed use, or the Clean Tech Innovation Park, it's a mixed-use park, and it consists of clean energy research and development, and that was slated that could be located in orange where the turbine building is and the domes are. It has a marina component for blue economic activity, and that's where the Royal Blue is down at the Intake Cove. A Chumash Community Center, which is identified in navy. And then expansion of the existing desalination plant, which is located in light blue. And then the larger area in green is where the thought could be that could be potentially wind onshore wind development. And under this concept, it would be the thought was that it would be managed by Cal Poly. Next slide. There's two different concepts dealing with recreation. The first one is campground and cabins, and this is this would be moderate intensity recreation. So it would have cabins, which are located in purple over at the bottom right hand corner, hike and camping, which is located above that in red, tent camping, which is over by the Intake Cove in magenta, RV camping in yellow, and then a marina in, which is where the Intake Cove is. Next slide. And the second recreation option is resort hotel. And this would be much higher intensity use. So there'd be potentially a lodge, which would be in pink, the cabins in purple, canyon yurts over in the red, the amphitheater, which is a teal color or green color, would be over where the existing firing range is located now. I thought that was a clever location. There'd be restaurant, general store, and then conference rooms. So again, much a recreation, but at a much higher intensity than, say, the camping. Next slide. So here's the energy storage option, and this is the one that Tom was mentioning. Under this concept, the whatever storage option would be used would be it would interconnect to the 230 and or 500 kV switch yards, and it would be located in green, so that bulk, basically the bulk of the power plant site. And storage options that were included in the EIR are battery storage, liquefied air, and mechanical gravity energy storage. Next slide. And then we also have energy research, and this would be a professional and student research collaboration on clean energy sources. And the buildings basically would be used for the colored areas that you see would be used for different research offices and labs, and then conference rooms. Next slide. And then we have institutional uses, and these uses could include a variety of different options, hospital, mental health treatment center, veterans affairs facility, Coast Guard training, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration facility, or a vocational training center. And any of these buildings identified could be used for a variety of those different uses. Next slide. And then the last concepts, I don't have figures that correspond with these, so I've grouped them together. But one would be cultural and historic preservation. And under that concept, a portion of the site would be transferred to the Native American community for preservation of archaeological sites. The site could also be used for meetings or ceremonies, other activities such as those. Another concept is upgrading the existing desalination plant and installing a conveyance pipeline to provide water, fresh water for Slo County. And then the last one we've talked about earlier is infrastructure for the Morro Bay wind energy area in terms of operation and maintenance type facilities. There have been several studies that did identify Diablo Canyon as a potential O&M type facility, and so that's another concept that could be included. So those are all the concepts that are included in the EIR. There's more information. It goes into much more detail describing each of these. It's actually in Section 8 of the draft. And I unfortunately didn't write the website down, but if you go to the County Planning and Building webpage and click under Active Projects, and you can just scroll down and the entire EIR can be accessed from that webpage. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Susan. Just want to mention that I know these slides are kind of hard to see right now for people. However, tomorrow, all of these slides will be available on the panel's website, and you can download them and view them right online at your leisure. And that website is DiabloCanyonPanel.org, and there's also a link to the Slo County's environmental impact report on that page also. So anyone have any questions, quick questions? Yes, Michael and then Patrick.
Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Can you tell us what the status of the EIR is and what the calendar for that looks like at this point?
Yeah, so we've been responding to comments that we've received. I have to say we have slowed down given input from PG&E and where things are with regard to extended operations. But at this point, we're shooting for the end of the year when the final EIR would be issued.
Thank you, Michael. Patrick?
Hi, thank you, Susan. I'm wondering if the concepts that you presented are mutually exclusive or it can be piecewise combined. For example, is the continued operation of the desalination plant contingent on these other uses that you've presented not happening?
No,
There's nothing that went that far in detail. They were just literally different concepts to give ideas of the types of activities that could occur post-decommissioning. So there's that. If I didn't mention desal in one of them, that doesn't mean it couldn't be there.
Thank you. Oh, Scott, thank you.
Thanks, Chuck. Susan, thank you for the presentation. Very informative. I just have make sure I understand, these concepts were created by the county, is that correct, or by the applicant?
They were created by several different sources, ultimately by the county, by Aspen, with our input. But at those first slides that I showed, where it had, you know, we took information from the strategic plan, different sources, and collectively came up with these concepts. But it did also include information provided by PG&E. The figures were provided by PG&E.
Okay, and also all these concepts are all based on the plant being decommissioned, meaning that there's several of the buildings would have to be removed in order to move forward on any of these types of concepts. And so it's my understanding, we also have a presentation tonight from GoBiz that will be focusing in on doing a similar thing for Parcel P going forward. Is that correct? I believe that's the situation. And will the county participate with that as far as kind of a lead on those concepts, or is that strictly going to be some third party out there that they award a contract to come up with those concepts?
I think we should defer to Dana. Excuse me, Dana Stroud from GoBiz and how they plan to move forward.
Okay, because the way I see it is that this is great information, but with the plant going forward for the next 5 years and potentially even longer, these are kind of like set aside. There's going to be some kind of combination or something thought of moving forward in the short term in order to look at that co-use aspect. Not a question.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Susan. I appreciate your presentation. Take care. Susan, any final comments?
No, that's it. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you. All right. Let's move on to the next.
Chuck, can we maybe...
We'll have the opportunity for public comment later in the agenda. So at that time, you'll have the opportunity to speak, sir. Thank you. All right. Our next agenda topic is offshore wind and Parcel P. As Bruce mentioned, offshore wind is potentially in the community's horizon. And we have three excellent speakers to speak to that tonight. Our first speaker, and we'll have an opportunity for questions and answers at the end of the three presentations. So if the panel members could jot down any questions you might have during the presentations, our speaker should be available to discuss those at the end of this segment. The first our speaker is on offshore wind projects, Matthew Blazek. He's with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. And Matthew is a renewable energy specialist at BOEM, the Pacific region, and he's the lead for future offshore wind lease planning in California. Matthew, thank you for being with us tonight. Go ahead with your comments.
Certainly. You're welcome, and thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on BOEM's behalf. So as Chuck mentioned, my name is Matthew Blazek, and I am a renewable energy specialist here at the BOEM Pacific region, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about our lease planning processes and activities. So next slide, please. Okay, so this slide here just quickly touches upon BOEM's mission, which is to manage the development of the U.S. Outer Continental Shelf. And specifically, we're managing the energy, mineral, and geological resources, and we do this in an environmentally and economically responsible way. Our jurisdiction, at least for our Pacific Regional Office, is on the U.S. West Coast, and that is basically California, Oregon, Washington, Hawaii, and the Pacific Territories. And this is the Outer Continental Shelf, which extends from 3 to at least 200 nautical miles offshore. However, our jurisdiction does not include national marine sanctuaries or other marine protected areas. You'll see those that are not within our jurisdiction kind of outlined in red there. Next slide, please. So this slide here is just a very oversimplified schematic of the basic components of a floating offshore wind farm. So first, on the left, in federal waters, the floating offshore wind turbines would operate in various arrays that will be determined by the lessees, and these are anchored by mooring lines to the seafloor. Next, in the middle there, you'll see that these turbines, as they generate and transmit wind energy, they send that to floating offshore substations via transmission cables. And then finally, towards the right, there will be additional transmission cables that connect these floating offshore substations to onshore electrical systems, which are located in state and local jurisdictions to deliver power. Next slide, please. So this is just a diagram of how we get to possible wind farms, at least on the BOEM authorization process. So this chart shows the BOEM wind energy authorization process broken down into four phases. And as hopefully you can see, and it sounds like you might have some trouble seeing slides, but each phase ranges from 1 to 5 years. And so it is a long time from planning to a potential construction of an offshore wind farm. So during each phase, BOEM coordinates and consults with tribal, federal, state, and local partners. And there are multiple stages of environmental review and public opportunities for comment. So I'll start quickly to describe each of these phases. So the first one there you see kind of in blue, this is the planning and analysis phase. And in this phase, BOEM establishes a intergovernmental renewable energy task force. It publishes a call for information nominations, as well as an area identification memo, and also conducts an environmental review, such as what you may have seen recently with BOEM's Morro Bay and Humboldt environmental assessments. This phase lasts about 1.5 to 2 years. The next phase, kind of moving along, is typically 1 to 2 years, and this includes the publication of leasing notices, conducting an auction, and lease issuance if companies secure high bids. And then for those companies that do basically win the auction or win the high bids, they acquire the leases after that auction, and then they enter the site assessment phase, so that third column. And in this phase, it can take up to 5 years, but maybe shorter. So here in California, leaseholders or lessees submit communication plans, survey plans, and site assessment plans for BOEM to review. After BOEM reviews and after lessees get the proper permits from all the different federal and state agencies, they can then begin their site characterization surveys. If you're not familiar with it, this is the phase that some current lessees are in for Morro Bay and Humboldt. Finally, the last column on the right, we have the construction and operations phase, which includes lessees submitting a construction operations plan, or what we call a COP, as well as a facility design report, fabrication and installation report, decommissioning plan, so on and so forth. The construction operations phase also includes multiple environmental and technical reviews, monitoring and reporting, as well as permitting from many state and federal agencies. And lastly, after the lessees get approvals and permits, especially approvals on this COP, only then can they begin constructing an offshore wind farm. Next slide, please. So this slide here just shows you, we kind of went through that process, or at least part of this wind energy authorization process here in California. So in December of 2022, there was an auction for 5 lease areas, 2 in Northern California and 3 in Central, that you'll kind of see in that map to the right. And this ended up generating $757 million in winning bids that went to the U.S. Treasury. So the 5 lessees that are currently active on the California coast or offshore California are RWE and California North Floating, which are Northern California. And then for Central California, we have Equinor, Golden State Wind, and Invenergy. Next slide, please. So as mentioned, the phase that we're at now with these lessees in California are that site assessment phase, which includes lessees submitting communication plans, survey plans, progress reports, and site assessment plans. There are 3 required communication plans, Native American Tribal, Agency, and Fisheries, that they must submit. And lessees are also required to submit those progress reports every 6 months to document the types of engagement that have taken place, as well as the actions that they have embarked upon to communicate with tribes and stakeholders. Next slide, please. So where do we go from here currently? So first, for the current lessees or current leases, all lessees have submitted those agency and fisheries communication plans, and the 3 Central Coast lessees have finalized a joint Native American tribal communication plan. All these communication plans are live and can be updated anytime, and they can be found on the lessees' websites, as well as BOEM has links to their websites as well on BOEM's website. For survey plans, 3 lessees have submitted these, and 1 lessee, Equinor, in Central California has started surveys recently within their lease area. All lessees have also submitted semi-annual progress reports, which is also posted to the BOEM's website if anybody is interested to view those. Finally, for the current lessees, BOEM is preparing a programmatic environmental impact statement for the Morro Bay and Humboldt lease areas, and this will identify and analyze programmatic avoidance, minimization, mitigation, and monitoring measures if lessees submit those future construction and operation plans or COPs. The record of decision from this PEIS will not approve any activities, and site-specific environmental analyses and consultations will still occur at that COP review stage in that next phase. Generally, if a COP proposes activities not captured by this PEIS, then future NEPA analyses on the COP will address those unique activities. As for future California leasing areas, you may or may not have heard, the Department of Interior announced recently a new 5-year offshore wind leasing schedule and has California Round 2 slated for 2028. In the meantime, BOEM is continuing to collaborate with the state of California, and we're eagerly awaiting the finalization of the state's draft AB 525 strategic plan. BOEM will also continue to conduct outreach with tribes and collect data via our partnership with NOAA's National Centers for Coastal Ocean Science, or NCOS, team that we have here. Next slide. I know there's some interest of what could potentially happen in the Diablo Canyon area. So first, I want to touch upon transmission here and BOEM's involvement. So first, transmission mainly falls under the state of California's jurisdiction, which I believe there's a presentation from Kaizo after this that may help to inform a little bit more what's going on there. However, BOEM is still contributing to transmission planning, and we do that through collaborative efforts with some federal state partners. So for instance, Department of Energy and BOEM are developing transmission recommendations for the West Coast through a convening series called West Coast Offshore Wind Transmission Series. And basically, these are convening meetings under four different tracks, and they are public, tribal nation, state, and technical. Meetings have already been held for each track, and currently BOEM is planning a next round of convening meetings. In addition, BOEM also includes cable easements for transmission lines when we issue offshore wind leases. However, the number, type, and location of cables are determined later by lessees in that construction and operations phase. Cables cannot be built or utilized until lessees prepare a COP, which is then approved by BOEM. Next slide, please. I believe Mr. Jones talked about some potential port opportunities, as well as the previous speaker before me. So I want to touch upon some potential port developments as they relate to offshore wind, which the panel may be interested in. So BOEM has funded multiple studies recently that assess existing California ports for their potential to support a future floating offshore wind industry to meet the state's goals of 25 gigawatts of offshore wind energy by 2045. In addition, a feasibility analysis was conduced to determine the estimated cost and timelines to upgrade existing ports to meet offshore wind requirements. These studies have helped to inform the state of California's land's AB 525 port readiness plan, as well as that state of California's AB 525 strategic plan. In addition, these studies helped to inform Department of Energy's NREL, or National Renewable Energy Lab, study, who completed a port study that looked at similar requirements, but not just California. It looked at the entire U.S. West Coast. Next slide, please. So before I get into the summary of the results from these studies, just wanted to kind of highlight the types of offshore wind ports. There are more than three, but these are the three main ones. So the main ones are staging and integration, manufacturing, fabrication, and then operation maintenance sites. So first, that top one, staging and integration sites are generally the largest and most expensive of all offshore wind ports, and that's because these allow for offshore wind components to be stored and assembled into turbines before they're towed out to sea. The middle one there, manufacturing and fabrication ports, this is where raw materials for the different offshore wind turbine components are stored, and then those individual components are created before they go to the staging and integration site. And then finally, operation maintenance ports are usually the smallest of the port types, and these support the ongoing maintenance of offshore turbines after they've been constructed. So here you might see maintenance crews, vessels, and spare parts being based here. Next slide, please. So I'm a little small, and I apologize if it's hard to read. Again, these slides can be available later as well. But this table basically shows the port assessment results for 17 existing California ports that were studied. And to the right, you'll see kind of three columns with a traffic light colored system there. And so those that are highlighted in red or yellow were deemed less suitable candidates for the three port types. whereas green were deemed more suitable. So I tried my best to, hopefully you can see it, highlight. You'll see in a light blue box, there is the Diablo Canyon Power Plant area, and this has been deemed as a potential candidate for an operation and maintenance type port. Just the conclusion from the studies showed that overall the port assessment that BOEM funded found that California does have enough potential port sites to meet California's 2045 deployment target for 25 gigawatts. However, there's a big however, offshore wind port sites require a substantial amount of investment to upgrade and improve the existing infrastructure to serve the offshore wind industry. Next slide, please. So just kind of zooming in a little bit, I know, again, Diablo Canyon is of interest here. So just going to highlight mainly that operation and maintenance port types. So typically, it costs $0 to $50 million for every 2 acres to retrofit or upgrade ports to meet the needs of an offshore wind industry. And for operation maintenance port sites, the timelines for permitting can be 4 to 7 years, and construction can be 3 years. I know all this sounds expensive and long time. This is actually the quickest and the cheapest compared to the other port types. So for Diablo Canyon specifically, you'll see it again kind of highlighted in the light blue box. It does have the potential to cost up to $10 million and take 7 to 10 years for permitting and construction to upgrade that area to an operation and maintenance type port. Again, this is what the studies found. And just some notes on what was included in these costs and timelines. It did include demolition for existing structures or features, such as a wharf or buildings on site. It also, there was some outreach done with Diablo Canyon Power Plant when they did these studies, and it was found that 2 to 10 acres of onshore area is available, but may not be directly adjacent to the pier. And then as far as the wharf goes, the Diablo Canyon Power Plant may be able to accommodate a crew transfer vessel, which is part of the operation and maintenance. And based on this berthing structure, there could be docks that are 150 feet long for that vessel. The existing water depth at the site is greater than 12 feet, so it can accommodate a CTV. So dredging is not required, which probably was the reason why the costs were a little bit cheaper there. So again, this is just an example. Nothing has been determined with regards to which existing ports in California will be used for offshore wind purposes. And there's still many discussions between a plethora of state, federal agencies, travel partners, and stakeholders to help figure that out. So more to come on that. But I realize I threw a lot of information at you, and so I appreciate you standing through my presentation here, and I look forward to any questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt, and appreciate your sticking around to the end of this topic, this segment, for questions. Matt had discussed the question of transmission capacity, and the state of California is responsible for onshore transmission capacity and planning. And we're fortunate to have with us tonight Jeff Billington, who's with the California Independent System Operators, otherwise known as CalISO or CalSO. And Jeff is the Director of Transmission Infrastructure Planning at CalISO. So, Jeff, we appreciate your being here.
Yeah, no, I appreciate in terms of being able to present and talk to you today. In regards to the slides, if you want to bring up the slide deck, I only have a few, and we can talk and then kind of some question and answers. But if you go to the next slide, just going to give it a little preface as to with our transmission planning. We do with a collaborative with the California Public Utilities Commission and the California Energy Commission. Back in 2022, we updated a memorandum of understanding in December of 2022 to really do a number of things. And if you look at the four kind of components that are in here, is to try to tighten the linkages between our planning, in particular the resource planning and transmission planning, as well as the procurement and the interconnection processes for resources connecting to the transmission system. And so that was to try to bring that so that basically we're aligning, tightening in those processes throughout the state. And the offshore wind is a component as we look at it. And in particular with the CEC, they're responsible for the load forecasting within the state. And that load forecasting is consistent between the resource planning that the CPUC does to develop their integrated resource plan, or their, if you've heard in terms of their IRP, and we utilize that in our transmission planning, as well as we use the portfolios that are provided by the Public Utilities Commission through their integrated resource planning in our transmission planning to determine what are the transmission needs, what transmission needs to be built to accommodate that plan, which is also, as we look in line in terms of to meet the state goals kind of through the SB 100 process. So that gives just kind of context of kind of the inputs to our planning, and then we go through our annual transmission planning process and determine what those needs are, and then seek approval from the ISO's board for the projects that we recommend. And in the case of this year's cycle, I'll be presenting tomorrow at the ISO's Board of Governors meeting the transmission plan, with which is what is identified for approval or recommended for approval. If you want to go to the next slide, this just highlights really the offshore wind that is in the resource portfolios that are provided to us for us to do our transmission planning. This is just the offshore wind I've got here. There's a total of, by 2035, I believe the number's around 85 gigawatt across the state that we're planning for a variety of different resource types, be it solar, storage, wind, out-of-state wind, the offshore wind here that's identified, geothermal for those purposes. But this is just the offshore wind, and it has both the Central Coast, so the Morro Bay call area, and as was described by Matthew in terms of as to the two call areas that have been designated, Morro Bay and then Humboldt up in the North Coast, and then Del Norte and Cape Mendocino are potential or hypothetical areas in the northern area that we were looking at as potential to look at plan, and those are only in the sensitivity or when we've done our 20-year outlook to look at the transmission needs, and the 20 years for informational, not for us to move forward with. And so if we look at the Morro Bay area in the base portfolio for this year, which is the shaded blue in the middle, 23-24 TPP, in that base portfolio is 3,000 megawatts or 3,100. We did look at a sensitivity up to about 5,300. And the 20-year outlook was looking at 5,400. There has been, and the developers have indicated that potential could be larger for the three call areas off Morro Bay. But these are the amounts that the CPUC has identified in their integrated resource plans. And like I said, the 3,100 is what we're planning for in the right now in the Morro Bay. I'll talk about in a few slides some of the potential and capabilities that we've done in studies. And then the Humboldt area, this is the first year that we had in the base portfolio capacity identified. And so we seek to recommend transmission approvals based upon the needs that we find in that base portfolio. And so for the North Coast, and if you, that's one difference between the North Coast and the Central Coast, so the Humboldt call area, the Morro Bay area. In the Morro Bay area, you have the Diablo power plant that is existing with 3,500 kV lines that connect back to the system. In the Humboldt area, you're looking at in terms of a system that is supplied by 2 115 kV lines and connected with the 60 kV system and a load that it's serving in the 150 megawatt area. And that's what the transmission was designed for. And so in this year's portfolio, we're recommending for transmission development up to the Humboldt area to connect the grid for the 1.6 gigawatt, as well as be flexible to be able to expand and grow in time. And that's what we'll be recommending in, or I'll be presenting to the board tomorrow, recommending for approval. Now, in the Morro Bay area, and like we indicated, there is transmission capacity with the 500 kV lines that were built for the Diablo Power Station and those requirements. And if you go to the next slide, when we did the analysis, we started doing analysis in the offshore, really in the starting on transmission, was the first sensitivity that was provided for us to assess was in the 21-22 transmission planning process. And what we determined was there could be an aggregate of 5.3 gigawatt of resource in the area. And so depending upon the Diablo power plant, that would vary in terms of from what the existing is and then how much wind could be identified or could be integrated into that system. And it's looking at connecting to the 500 kV system. The 230 and the 500 kV in the area are not interconnected together. And the 230 supplies loads in the area, as well as there's other resources that are connected to it, being out of solar and other in our interconnection and existing and in the interconnection queues. And so when we looked at it, is can all the generation connect into Diablo, or is there a need up kind of by the Morro Bay area for an additional 500 kV interconnection that one or all could interconnect to there as an alternative? And then the other thing, and the diagram on the right really looks at if we were to go above the 5.3 gigawatt or the capability of the 230 kV system, we would need additional transmission, and that would be really from the Diablo up to the Moss Landing with a DC link because of the distances, a DC link from Diablo down into the LA Basin, or an additional 500 kV line from Diablo to the Gate substation that goes through that area. And so that's kind of, if we're looking at kind of at a high level, the interconnection, and then if and what the transmission capabilities are, and if the capacities grow beyond, or if the Diablo was to stay for a longer time period, we would need additional transmission to be able to accommodate wind. And based on the base portfolio of 3 gigawatt and Diablo, we'd be right in that area as to being able to what could be accommodated. But to go beyond that with offshore wind and Diablo, or to go beyond the 5.3 with the offshore wind, would require further transmission enhancements. And so if we go to the next slide, this really just illustrates the same. And as we're looking at the wind interconnection, just kind of showing is if all was to connect at Diablo, if we had where the resources were split, where some of it came to the new substation, some to Diablo, we could accommodate probably approximately up to the 2,500 megawatt. If we wanted to connect all of the resources at a new station and not Diablo, that would result in basically needing of a transmission line to connect back to Diablo so that you have access to those two lines plus the existing one line to Gates, so that you have the basically transmission capacity to evacuate the power out of the area in there. So that's the main and what I was going to talk about. And I know there's questions with regards to the interconnection. I'm not sure if Divya will be touching on it as well, but and it was the questions and the discussions that Tom was really alluding to. This is looking at the transmission system and what the requirements are. You can see on the lines really saying from really coming from the generator to the Diablo substation. That's a very simplistic look at it, and it all depends upon what the developer of the wind farm and how they develop their wind farm and the cables that are to come to shore. And there's really three options that would have. One would be coming in from 500 kV from the offshore wind and the floating substation that was kind of indicating a Matthew substation. But when it comes onto shore, it's going to need to come on land and have a transition. And there will be a need for a station, even if it's just the 500, because as they bring that 500 in the distances, there's what and try to put it in terms of, as we look at it, is the voltage rises on underground cables. That's one of the things with 500 and limitations on distances or capabilities and the limited underground on land for 500 kV utilization, is that there'll be a need for like a what's called a reactor station to be able to bring the voltage down before it's interconnected into the substation. And so that's one if it's needed. So there'll be it would probably be the smaller of any of the ones if needed for as it comes on land. Some of the, as the developers look at coming with a lower voltage cable, and say it's around 287 kV. So as the cables come on shore and then come in, there will be need for a substation to basically terminate those lines, a transformers to transform that from 287 to 500, and then interconnect into the Diablo station. And if they were to look at using HVDC, and these are all design criteria based upon the distance that they are, the capacity, and also technologies, because there isn't all of the floating with the floating platforms and what we call dynamic cables, so that they basically can move with the floating, especially at the high voltages and capabilities. But if they come with an HVDC, they would have an HVDC converter at the floating platform. It would come on land, and that HVDC would need a converter station to take it from the HVDC, convert that HVDC to an AC, stepped up to 500 kV to interconnect. And the numbers that were identified for what those facilities being the size or the acreages would probably be in the range of for the AC being of the 500 or a lower voltage that has the transformer needs being in the 5 to 10 acre range. And from talking to HVDC manufacturers, if it's an HVDC, it's roughly in the 12-acre range, like 700 feet by 700 feet, really being the size of what that converter station would be required. So that's as we look at it, and so as we're planning, some of the information for the connection component to get from the wind farm on land where it comes to the substation, which is identified as connecting to the grid, and then how we're planning kind of the grid itself in the area, depending upon the capacities that develop, and in particular that are planned for through the CPUC's interconnected or the IRP for that purpose. So with that, I'll leave it there and then go to the next presentation, and if there are any questions, I'll be around to be able to answer them at the end. And the next slide just is my contact information.
Chuck, can we take...
Thank you, Jeff. Can we hold our questions until the end? We are running a little late.
But I think that there's a lot of confusion about that presentation. And I just wanted to clarify so that I understand what Jeff is saying. Are you saying that there's 5.4 gigawatts available transmission capacity for offshore wind if Diablo closes? Is that a summary, or did I get that wrong?
That's correct. That's correct. Okay.
Thank you.
And one
Thank
more
you,
quick
Go ahead, Linda.
Question. Can you please tell us the difference between a sensitivity portfolio and a base portfolio, just in like a couple of words? I don't understand what that means.
Sensitivity portfolio is provided to us by the CPUC for informational to help them in the development of their resource planning and what are some of the needs. In the base portfolio is what we will, if there's needs that are identified for transmission upgrades based upon the base portfolio, we'll determine what that need is, develop the alternatives, and make a recommendation. That recommendation we take to our board of governors for approval, and then from there the development of those facilities go through the process of depending upon how to the incumbent utility or under certain specific criteria that we have, we go for competitive solicitation for somebody to build those facilities.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. And again, we appreciate you hanging in there until after the next presentation for any questions. Our next presenter and last presenter on the segment of offshore wind is the topic is onshore infrastructure requirements, and we're fortunate to have with us Dr. Jijiva Chandrasekara, which I know I pronounced that incorrectly. She is otherwise known, I understand, as Dr. D. And Dr. D is a senior lead specialist at Ørsted, which is a Danish company with over 15 years' experience with offshore wind and renewable energy systems. Dr. D, are you online?
Yes. Can you see me and can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you so much for that introduction. And really happy to be here. I think I got a great segue from Jeff from the previous presentation. So what I would be focusing is what we have done in offshore wind development in the Atlantic coast. So certainly you won't hear anything about floating structures, which is going to be very interesting in the West Coast. In the East Coast, we have fixed bottom. So definitely something very different. But with that in mind, I think on the terrestrial or the land side, you wouldn't see so much of a difference, I would imagine, when it comes to offshore wind development for the land infrastructure. If you could go to the next slide, please. So I'll just give you a brief overview of what an offshore wind farm layout would look like and some ideas about onshore works that's required for developing offshore wind farm, and show you a little bit of an example of an offshore wind project we completed in the Northeast, and that's in operation. Again, I think I do want people to keep in mind that every design is unique and the land requirement onshore is going to be different based on the design you pick, the type of transmission technology, the voltage of the transmission technology, your substation design, is it GIS or AIS? So it's going to be very dependent on those. So I'll give you some indicative ideas, initial ideas, but they're no means concrete. Once you start going into the details, of course, you could reduce footprint by using slightly different technology. So if you move to the next slide, please. So an offshore wind farm layout, typically you would have the turbines in the water. You would see only fixed bottom because it's the Atlantic region we are building these. And you would have what we call as array cables. Array cables are typically medium voltage. It's about 6 to 6 kV. So we have an offshore substation, which basically scales up the voltage if it is HVAC. And the export cable that comes out is 275 kV or high voltage. In some designs, there have been 230 kV or 138 kV for a small offshore wind farm. Again, for the larger ones, around 700, 800 megawatts, you're typically looking at 275 kV export cable. So the purpose of the offshore substation, if it is an AC connected, it's mainly voltage scaling. And if it is HVDC, the offshore substation is a rectifier station. This is a voltage source converter-based technology, and it would operate as a rectifier station. And so far, most designs, we've used 320 kV monopole HVDC systems. So you would have a DC export cable, 320 kV DC export cable coming out. And typically, this export cable will do a beach landing or what we call as landfall. And from there, there's a transition joint bay, and we connect the export cable going on to the onshore substation. The onshore substation is always required, mainly for voltage scaling. So if you're coming at 275 and you're connecting it to a 500 kV or a 345 kV system, you really need to scale the voltage, and that's the transformer you put in. And there are interconnection requirements or grid codes that you have to meet. Maybe you have to provide some reactive power support to the grid. So those kinds of or balance of plant equipment would be placed in the onshore substation. In many cases, we have STATCOMs that provide the dynamic wire capability for meeting the onshore requirements. And in some designs, we've even had synchronous condenser because the grid short circuit was really low, and we had to put in a synchronous condenser to strengthen the grid at the onshore POI. And in one of the designs, we have actually a voltage source HVDC converter. So we would have an inverter station onshore coming in there. If you move to the next slide, please. I think I don't see the next slide. Yeah, thank you. So the export cable typically makes a landfall. So from sea to shore, there's a transition. And typically in the parking lot, we would have a transition joint bay. And there we pull the cable out from the beach area. And most often it's done via HDD just to minimize the impacts to the environmental and minimize the environmental impacts. So that's if we don't do an open cut in many cases. And once it's pulled at the parking lot at the transition joint bay, we connect the cable that would go to the onshore substation. This export cable would go onshore. So if you move to the next screen, please. Yep. So there's a transition joint bay, and this export cable goes all the way onshore. And this cable goes in public properties or private right-of-way. Again, it depends on the point of interconnection, the local utility or transmission system to which you want to connect to, and where you can secure right-of-way. And it could be several miles, tens or 20, or in some cases, 30, 40 miles to get to the point of interconnection or the local utility. So if you go to the next slide. Yeah, and again, here, once the export cable comes in, there's an onshore substation. Generally, it's located to close proximity to the local transmission network, a utility most often, or 230 kV or 500 kV or 138 kV in some instances, local utility network. And the onshore, the purpose of the onshore substation really is this export cable terminates in the onshore substation. And if it is AC, then there's a transformer here, so there would be voltage scaling. And also, there would be additional balance of plant equipment that may be necessary to ensure reliable operation when you connect it to the grid, or to ensure you can meet some of the requirements that are laid out in your interconnection agreement. So that is the purpose. And as I said, for AC connected onshore substations, we've had synchronous condensers being put in there for some of our projects. And for some of our projects, it's just STATCOM. For some, we have combination of synchronous condenser and STATCOM. For HVDC connected project, the onshore substation would house an inverter station. So it goes from DC to AC. So 320 kV DC gets transformed to the local utility transmission voltage. And that's really the purpose of this. So from an acreage perspective, the acreage is very variable. It depends on the onshore substation design because a lot of our projects are in densely populated areas like New York City, Long Island, where space I would say it's very constrained. And in those cases, we use GIS or gas insulated substation designs to reduce the footprint. And we try to house most of the equipment in there. But there are certain cases where it may not be feasible to have GIS designs, and you may have to go in for AIS, which would obviously increase the footprint. And also, as you include additional balance of plant equipment like synchronous condensers, the footprint obviously increases. For voltage source HVDC converter station, again, it depends on the design. So there are certain designs where you can house the converter station vertically in land-constrained areas. But there are also designs where you can comfortably fit it in the space that you have. again, there's a lot of flexibility around that. And from the onshore substation to the local transmission, most often this is a very short cable or a transmission line connecting to the local utility. And the preference for this cable or line preference is generally agreed upon with the local utility. Next slide, please. And again, this is just an example. So this is the South Fork Wind Farm, one of the first commercially operated offshore wind in the Atlantic region and in the U.S. So this is a very small 138 kV, 130 megawatt offshore wind. And we have 138 kV export cable. And if you see the substation, the export cable route is shown in blue on your right-hand side, the map that you see, and there's a orange dot or with number 3 that states it's a substation. That's the onshore substation that's housed next to the utility substation. So if you see on the visual map onto your left, the South Fork Wind Farm, I'm sorry you may not be able to see the markings, but it's on the very left, the substation, and the control room is on the very left. So I think this would be available eventually, and this gives you an indication of how big the substation could be. But again, this is a very small offshore wind farm, and we have only a STATCOM that's housed here. So there's minimum balance of plant equipment. And may not be fully indicative, but gives you an idea. There are other projects, as I said, where we have a voltage source converter, HVDC station on land, and we have projects where we have HVAC with synchronous condenser and STATCOM. So the footprint for those is definitely larger than this. So with that, I think if we move to the I think next is the last slide. The inland right-of-way is very project and design specific. So it's heavily dictated by the export cable rating. Is it a HVAC or a DC project? And what is the rating, the voltage rating of your export cable? And how much of power you're transmitting onshore. The substation itself, the location of the substation is generally close to the utility, and the size of the onshore substation is dependent, again, on the design. Is it AC or is it DC design? And even there, you have GIS, AIS, and AC. Most HVDC substations are all GIS switchgears, GIS substations, so you don't see that much of a difference. But again, it could be vertical design where you have constrained space. And the AC designs could be very different based on the project needs, as I said, for balance of plant equipment. The connection from onshore substation to the utility is most often agreed upon by the local utility and can be done either via a cable or a line. And the right-of-way for these is not too much compared to the export cable right-of-way. I think that was it, and I would end my presentation there. Thank you.
Thank you, Jetiva. Now is the opportunity for questions. Does the panel have any questions of any of the three speakers? Michael and Patrick, Scott and Kara, and Bruce.
I guess, Mike, thank you all for those amazing presentations. I like the diagrammatic nature of breaking this complex thing down. I think so, yeah. I guess this is for Jeff. if I understand your three diagrams right, the cabling is coming into the Diablo site, or it's coming into Morro Bay, or potentially it's coming into both. If in all of those diagrams you showed, if it's coming into Morro Bay, it requires an additional substation capacity, and that seems to be something that the doctor showed in her presentation is required for any cabling coming in. So I guess my question is that correct, that you're looking at a potential of those three scenarios for it coming into all Diablo, all Morro Bay, or a combination of the two?
That's correct. And you're right, with the Morro Bay would require a new 500 kV substation that would connect into the Diablo to Gates substation.
And I guess the other thing, since we're talking mostly about Diablo, I'm a Morro Bay resident, so I'm very interested in what happens up in Morro Bay. But the it looked like there was a factor of, I think it was your slide, a factor of about 4 of the cost of going into Diablo versus Morro Bay. Was that your slide?
I didn't have any of the costs for going to there, because it would depend upon what the technology and from the wind farm to the area and the distances difference between going from Morro Bay to the wind farm or Diablo to the wind farms for those purposes.
Okay, so what you're saying is if it comes into Diablo, there's no additional transformer capacity needed here, but if we go into Morro Bay, there does have to be an additional transformer capacity.
Well, not transformer capacity, site. Because like I said, the site itself is switching station capability. You'd need a new switching station, because there isn't on that line, and you can't just tap the line. You need a switching station for, like, what's a Diablo for the offshore wind to connect. That's the transmission grid component, and there is still, depending upon the technology of the developer, land and a substation needed, either for voltage control, as Divya indicated, or transformers if the voltage isn't 500 kV and it is a lower voltage that comes on. You would need a on land of the developers for transformers, or if there's HVDC, you would need an HVDC converter station to convert it from HVDC and then interconnected into the transmission system, which would either be at Diablo existing substation or that new substation we talk about up in Morro Bay area.
Okay. And I guess the other question then would be for Matthew about that cost differential with your port assessment. Was that just for the maintenance and operation aspect of the project that didn't have any on-site landing of the cabling and things like that? Is that correct?
No. Correct. It did not talk about the port system. Did not talk about the transmission. It was more just upgrading the ports in general for more like vessels and stuff. That operation and maintenance aspect of the turbines themselves. I mean, it could potentially. I don't recall it talking about transmission in the study itself, like maintenance of transmission lines. But that could be a factor. But it wasn't. Yeah, I can't recall that.
Since we're all ratepayers here, one of the things that interests me. Can you say in just a short summary why there's such a 4 times difference between Diablo and Morro Bay? What's the nature of the cost difference there that's that high?
I would have to check on Morro Bay, but I want to say for Diablo it was cheaper because of dredging not being involved or being necessary for the port. I'm not as brushed up on the Morro Bay port of why that might be more expensive.
And from your point of view, did that have a time issue about the continuing operation, whether it goes to Morro Bay or Diablo, as to the efficiency of the startup and things like that?
No time frame. That's something for the lessees and more so the state of California to figure out after that site assessment phase. So as kind of mentioned, the site assessment phase could last up to 5 years. But I mean, hopefully that's things are determined along the way, just so that, because it does take a long time for permitting and then eventual construction for the port itself. So but yeah, there's no set time frame, just ballparks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. We have a limited amount of time, and we have about 5 people who want to ask questions. So I'd ask our panel members and the speakers to be as concise as possible. Patrick.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks to all the speakers as well. Yeah, my question is for Matthew as well.
I'm still a little confused about the timeline of the offshore project. Two of your slides in particular, one was for the authorization process, which had the four columns, and my understanding is now we're smack in the middle of the site assessment phase. The lease haven't been granted, which could take up to 5 years, so we're about 2 years into that, so I'm expecting maybe three more years max. And then 3 years for construction and operations. So that puts us at about 8 years from now, and that's basically planning and paperwork, right? This is construction has not started yet, and yet for the operation and maintenance sites, which I assume has to happen at the same time that the construction of the actual wind site takes place, there's a 4 to 7 year permitting period requirement there that you've got. Has that started? Is this going on in parallel? Because you have multiple paths there for that one as well, and they're not going to, these companies are not going to apply for permits for multiple places at the same time, I'm assuming.
You are correct. Things should be happening hopefully simultaneously. As far as the BOEM authorization process goes, they are in that site assessment phase, but they really just started the site surveys. Like, Equinor is the only one so far, and that was at the end of April, so only really just for a few weeks. And so they do have the ability or the bandwidth to survey up to 5 years, and then they'll submit in conjunction of creating that construction operations plan, which then BOEM has to review, as well as they will have to get permits from other agencies. So there is a long timeline that potentially could be there, but they could be quicker. It just depends on how engaged. Like, some lessees have submitted survey plans, others have not, and so it just really depends on each lease. And then on the other side, as far as the port development goes and the time frames, I know the state of California has been talking with all the different authorities and stuff. Again, that's more on the state side since it's on shore. But yeah, that is something that they're looking at, assessing which ports potentially these lessees could be transmitting their transmission and power to, as well as which ones they could be using for the different types of offshore wind ports. So I know, like, Long Beach and Humboldt got some grants, and they're trying to expand their ports for more of a staging and integration. I haven't heard much yet on manufacturing and fabrication, as well as operation and maintenance ports, but those hopefully are being considered across the, again, all the different state agencies and industry as well.
So in presentations that I've heard from Invenergy and Equinor and Golden State, I was left with the impression that they're expecting construction to start by around 2030 to 35. Does that jive with the timeline you are predicting with these various agencies as well?
That is a scenario. Again, just kind of depends on how quickly they can get out there with their surveys and how their surveys go and what they find, and again, how quickly they can develop those construction operation plans and get those approved. So that is within the realm of possibilities, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Scott, you had a question.
Yes, actually I have five questions, but they will be really quick. First of all, my understanding is that there needs to be some kind of offshore substation, whether floating, I guess on the East Coast it's fixed. Just concerned or interested, if anyone can answer this, as far as what size that is. Is it square feet? Is it acres? Or what will be floating? That would be one question. Another question would be onshore. What is the average size of the onshore station? And I understand if we have three different contractors or vendors or suppliers, it seems like we'll need three substations on site, let's say on Parcel P somewhere. And then I was also interested in the PEIS. There was apparently you're in the works of doing the draft, and I was wondering about the timeline when you will have, public will have an opportunity to weigh in on that. And then as far as the marina, looking at it becoming an O&M or either a construction port, I'm very interested in the amount of trips in and out of the marina. I'm assuming that someone would have an estimate of what the normal number of trips in and out of the marina. And those are the five.
Anyone want to take on those questions?
Well, I can touch, because I'll start with the first one. The offshore, again, will depend upon what is the technology that they're using to bring the power onto shore. And so you're looking at the cables coming in step-up transformers from the cables from each of the wind farms that are collected. And so you're probably looking in the same of almost a 10-acre type in size, but depends upon how much they can do also with the stacking of it. Sure. And the floating onshore, I think I mentioned, in terms of depending upon the technology coming in or what they're using, it'll range somewhere between probably 5 on the lower end, which might be a bit small, up to about 12 acres for the HVDC converter station. So somewhere between probably in that 5 to 12 acre range, depending upon the technology. Now I'm trying to remember the other questions that you had.
I think the other one's for Boehm as far as the timeline for the PEIS.
Okay, good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for the PEIS, so we are have to follow by the Council of Environmental Quality, that they're at the White House, so their timelines and new guidelines for NEPA documents. And so I believe it's 2 years from the notice of intent to the release of the record of decision. And so there's not a timeline yet of when a draft will be published, but I have heard through other, that's not my realm at Boehm, but I have heard through our sister office here at the Environmental Office at Boehm that potentially in the fall we'll have a draft where people can look at and provide public comment.
Okay, and then the last question relates to the number of trips in and out of the marina for O&M or either construction.
Yes, so I was trying to quickly look through the studies. It just talks about day trips and multi-day trips, but it didn't talk about how many per se. But that's something that I can try and look deeper into and get back to you on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question is from Kara.
Scott answered, asked the right questions. I'm good. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Bruce, you had a question.
Yeah, this question I think is directed to Jeff, and when we heard from Tom at PG&E, Tom Jones, earlier, he was saying that there was approximately 3.8 gigawatts of capacity that would be available, transmission capacity at Diablo Canyon, even if continued operations occurred over a longer period of time. And I wasn't sure if your 5.3 gigawatt figure accounted for that. Could you give
I'm
a breakdown of like how much of the 5.3 is capacity that is existing at Morro Bay versus how much would be existing at Diablo Canyon with and without the scenario of continued operation?
Well, the 5.3 is based upon looking at the three 500 kV lines that come into the Diablo. That's how much offshore wind could be accommodated without Diablo. If Diablo is in operation, effectively take 5.3 minus what Diablo's output is. So that puts you down to almost the 3 gigawatt range for what's available. If we're connecting at Diablo, that's what that capability is. If you're connecting all of it at creating a new station, connecting to the 500 at Morro Bay, I believe it's in around the 2,500. And to go up to the 5.3, you would need another line from that new station back to Diablo so as to have the same effective output from the area. And so that's where that comes from. I'm not sure where the 3.8 that Tom had referred, you're referencing, Tom had indicated, because that's more than what the capability would be with Diablo plus offshore wind.
That's a good question. Do you guys talk often?
We talk regularly. I don't know where that number. These numbers we've been communicating since. Yeah.
I don't believe I said that number or used a specific number, Mr. Simmons.
Okay. I'm sorry. Can you repeat that, Tom?
I said I don't recall using such a specific number and tried to defer some of this specificity to Jeff by name in my answer.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I took some notes. I had 6 gigawatts and that there was 2.2 gigawatts of capacity at Diablo Canyon and there was roughly 3.8 gigawatt balance.
I think the 6 was referenced by one of your panel members.
Okay. So that was incorrect.
That's correct. You were incorrect.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Dave, you had a question?
Most of my questions have been addressed. I have a couple remaining. Marine preserves and reserves, is there any consideration for the offshore wind? And I'll direct that to Matthew at Boehm.
Just as far as siting goes?
Yeah, is that a effect or constrain the placement of offshore wind for us?
Marine protected areas and other types of things like marine national monuments, that falls outside Boehm's jurisdiction. So no, we cannot issue leases into those areas. So that would be a constraint.
Okay. And then there's lease payments. You said that those go to the U.S. Treasury. Is that a lump sum or is that an ongoing thing as power is generated over the years? And does any of that flow to the state and or the county?
Oh, I think what I was talking about was the actual lease sale. It wasn't like royalties or anything like that, like as ongoing. It's just for the lease sale itself, that money that was generated went to the U.S. Treasury.
Okay. Tom, did you have something to say about that?
I did. That's for Boehm's jurisdictional areas. There would be a lease required through the California State Lands Commission from the 3 miles into the intertidal zone, and that would be subject to negotiation and appraisal from the state.
Okay, thanks. Then a question for Dr. D. The onshore substations that you were referring to, are those enclosed or are they open air?
So as I said, most of it that we are building is GIS, so they are closed, enclosed substations and gas insulated. Again, the restriction came because, as you can imagine, in New York City, getting into Long Island, the land is a premium. So we just had to get it to work. Having said that, since you're discussing about retirements and power plants, I think one of the things you really have to keep in mind is contamination. So maybe even if you have a large land area, it may be a lot more difficult to use maybe because of contamination. So something to keep in mind.
Okay, thanks. And then last question. So the footprint that you showed from the East Coast example, that was 130 megawatts. What we're talking about here is potentially 10 to 40 times as large as that. Does that footprint scale up with the capacity, or is it not linear?
It's not linear. That's why it gets a little tricky. So the scaling, the transformer size is going to increase, but it's not a linear increase. The more challenging part is what comes from the grid side. Right. If you start including balance of plant equipment, like as I said, for some designs, we have synchronous condenser. Obviously, the footprint you would need is a lot more, and it has to be in an area where it's accessible for O&M. So it depends on a specific project design. I think it's more standardized for HVDC. If you're looking standard ones, you can get those from Hitachi and Siemens, the standard footprint.
Just to know that it's not linear and that we don't have something 40 times as big as what you showed. That's really what I want to know. Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Dave. One last quick question, Kara. We have to move on.
So I guess I'm just asking for confirmation from one of the speakers. PG&E has applied for a 20-year license extension, but I think it's fair to say that if offshore wind is fully built out as planned for the long run, there is insufficient transmission capacity at Diablo. So either Diablo would have to close to accommodate space for wind, or additional transmission capacity would have to be developed. That's correct, right?
If you're looking in terms of with Diablo staying in service, integrated resource plans go beyond 3 gigawatt for the offshore wind, then that they currently are in our base portfolios, then you would require some additional transmission to effectively evacuate the power out of that area to the grid. And those are the three alternatives that we looked at in that one that I identified is three different alternatives that would be needed to expand beyond the 5.3 aggregate generating resource in that area.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. It is time for a break. I want to thank Jeff, Matt, and Ichiva for being excellent speakers, and especially for staying with us for those of you who are on Eastern time zones. So thank you all very much. Before we take our break, I'd like to get an idea of the number of public members that would like to speak tonight. For those here in attendance, if anybody wants to speak, hold up your hand. Okay, and how about online? Can you hold on. For those online that would like to make a public comment, could you please raise your hand on the Zoom system? Okay. We've got an idea of the number of speakers that we'll have. The public comment period will take place after our next speaker at approximately 8:15 to 8:30. So let's take a 5-minute break right now and reconvene at 7:50. Let's reconvene the meeting and proceed with our last speaker tonight. We're very fortunate this evening to have Dana Stroud with us. She represents the Governor's Office of Business and Economic Development, or otherwise known as GoBiz. And she is the Associate Deputy Director for Community and Place-Based Solutions. And she's going to speak to us tonight about GoBiz's Senate Bill 846, Parcel P, Repurposing Analysis and Funding. Dana, are you with us tonight?
I am. Can you hear me?
We sure can. Thank you for joining us.
Great. Thank you. And I will apologize in advance if there is any background noise. I am parked at a Shell gas station on I-5, and there's traffic, so I apologize for any background noise. And thank you for having me this evening, and apologies for not being there in person. I live in Paso Robles, which is just up the road from where you are tonight, but unfortunately, I had a prior commitment to be in Merced today, and so I'm working my way back to Paso Robles, and therein why I'm coming in virtually this evening. I just want to provide a brief update on the SB 846 and the GoBiz portion of the funding that came out of SB 846, specifically for a reuse economic development strategy for Parcel P at Diablo Canyon Power Plant. As you might recall, last fall, my senior business advisor, Kina Pereira, participated in your meeting and provided a brief update at that time also. And things have changed slightly since he visited you last fall. So here we are in May. We've had some staffing transitions that have created a bit of a refocus for our team. Kina has moved over to the California Workforce Development Board. So that's with that transition, we've had a slight delay. But here is what our strategy is for moving forward with our economic development strategy and reuse for Parcel P. Our intent, as it stands currently, is to prepare an RFP and distribute for comment in late July, early August. And when we say distribute for comment, we certainly intend to route it at the local, state, regional level for any input that we would like to hear and receive from the community as it relates to the scope of work that we would be proposing in this RFP that we would then use to solicit proposals for consultants to assist us in the development of this plan. So our current timeline is a late July, early August to distribute for public input. Following that, we would receive that input. And then at the end of August, early September, issue the RFP for solicitation of proposals and review proposals and award and contract with consultant October, early November, with kickoff to begin as that contract is executed. That would put us on about an 18 to 19 month window for completing this work. Spring of 26 would be our target as the timeline for the funding that has been appropriated does expire at the end of that fiscal year 26. So our intent, and I heard an earlier question, I think panel member Scott Lathrop, you asked the question about existing documents. Certainly, if you recall, our director, Myers, was in the area last winter, February of 23, along with CNRA Secretary Wade Crowfoot, to participate in a series of community-led meetings around the Diablo decommissioning, and we received input there. But if you recall, there were several reports and studies that were referenced during that visit. And Susan Strachan, in her draft EIR, referenced what those some of those documents are that we would intend to integrate into or use as informational to help inform some structure relative to the plan. I would also just add that our intent is certainly to use outside consulting sources, retaining the services of an outside consultant, but GoBiz would be the project manager of it, and we would certainly anticipate significant community engagement using much of the groundwork that has already been completed in the region by a variety of partners to, if you will, tee up this final discussion around reuse. We are also, and have been reassured to date that the $5 million that was set aside for GoBiz to use, it will not be affected by the budget considerations. And we will, you know, have that reaffirmed as the legislation approves the budget mid-June, and then we have the governor who will sign it hopefully by July 1st. So that is our timeline. That is our intent. And unless something drastic happens between now and June 15 or July 1, that's the schedule that we will work from. I did want to just reiterate, you saw Parcel P slides earlier tonight, both on Susan's presentation and in Tom's presentation, so you're fully aware of the scope, if you will, that we're looking at. At the same time, though, what we're considering with this is the, if you will, the kind of the broader economic footprint for the reuse opportunities and how the potential reuse might fit into a community-led economic growth leading to the well-paying jobs that we're looking to identify and be located out there with the potential reuse at Parcel P. So we want to, through this process, ensure that there is the consideration for the reuse aligns with many of the industry sectors that are being identified as priority sectors in the greater Central Coast region. I think with all the information, pre-work that has been done already and information that has been being shared, historical information that we can look at, I feel very confident that we'll be able to identify what those, identify the alignment with the industry sectors that are emerging in the Central Coast. So a focus is the community economic growth along with well-paying jobs that come with that reuse, and that's going to be a key part of the reuse strategy. I don't have any other points to make at this time, so I am happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Great. Thank you, Dana. Panel members, any questions? Yes, Linda and Dina.
Just turn myself off. Okay. This might be a very elementary question. How does this analysis and funding, how does this account for what I understand is the first right of refusal to the native folks for the I guess, purchase of some of the lands?
I think that's a great sense? Yeah, you are. I don't have a direct response to that. I'm looking at my colleague at PG&E, if Tom has a response to that, but we are not in a position to directly respond to that at this moment.
Yeah, I think stepping back more broadly, these strategies and recommendations aren't binding and don't drive a forced action. The requirement you spoke about, Linda, is for utility-owned properties, and Parcel P is not owned by the utility, it's leased. It's owned by Eureka Energy, and it's not subject to the tribal policy. So that tribal policy is required on first right of refusal for things like the Energy Education Center and all of the properties that are to the north. When I showed that original map as slide one tonight on my presentation, I didn't go over this, but everything outlined in gold is owned by the utility. And then everything in the seafoam green is owned by that unregulated affiliate called Eureka Energy. So they're different. Unfortunately, there are many different regulatory processes across different parcels on the facility. Lastly, for any repurposing, if the asset sits on the Eureka dirt but was paid for by customer funds, let's just say the warehouse, the CPUC has a proceeding called an 851 proceeding, and they have to determine that our desire to have a disposition of the asset to a third party is in customers' interest, and those revenues, that component of that deal, goes back to rates to offset the cost of operating utility. So customers get something out if they put something in.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Dina?
Tom.
Dina, and then Seeley and Kara and Dave.
Sure. Thanks, Chuck. Thank you, Dana.
I'm going to jump in here a minute real quick. And obviously, Linda Seeley has been on the panel since its inception in 2018. We lovingly call her Linda. But now we have two Lindas with the new appointment of Linda Vanasoop. So the ladies have agreed that Linda Seeley would prefer to be called Seeley, as many of her friends call her, and Linda Vanasoop would prefer to be called LV, as many of her friends call her. That's our protocol from this point forward. So Seeley, and then LV, or who's next anyway? Kara.
Okay.
Go ahead, Seeley.
It's me. So.
Dina.
Thank you, Dana, so much for that. I really was not that familiar with the time frame of this process, so thank you. I am wondering, is it a public process or is it an internal research analysis? What is the process going to be?
Yeah, utilizing the services of a consultant to assist us with it, we would anticipate that we would build on some of the previous public engagement opportunities, as well as provide the public for some input on the development of the strategy. It is not necessarily required per se to be like an official public hearing or anything like that, mm-hmm. but recognizing the great engagement that the community has had over the course of time, we would anticipate that there will be opportunities for public participation, public review, public input, as this gets developed.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dina. Seeley?
Thank you, Anders. Okay, this may also be a question you can't answer, but it's like a strange kind of parallel universe or something. That are you talking about? Your assumption is that the plant will shut down in 2030, and then GoBiz will be able to go and do its biz? Or are you... How... I don't understand this whole thing. It seems like unrealistic or not... We're talking about so many different things at the same time that I don't see how you could make any kind of a credible plan whatsoever. But correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that's a fair question. Let me provide a quick clarification. GoBiz, can you hear me okay? Sorry, I'm getting a note that my internet is unstable. Can you hear me all right?
We can hear you fine.
Okay, thank you. In the middle, I might shut off my video just to preserve the internet stability. Mobile hotspots, GoBiz is not in the business of operating any facilities or operating any companies, if you will. GoBiz serves as the state's lead agency around economic development opportunities, providing assistance to businesses and companies that are looking to locate in California, and working very collaboratively with our communities around the state to assist with their economic goals that they've established at the local level. So there is not an intent out of the box for GoBiz to be operating anything as this moves forward. I would also add there are people on this call that have much more insight that I'm sure that they're willing to share as well. But just briefly, as a result of the announcement that came from PG&E for the closure, and at the timeline for the closure, there was great concern raised around how does the county and the region as a whole. How is the region going to either recover or sustain itself due to the loss of some jobs that with the closure of Diablo? So there was great questions asked. Well, what do we do? And is there an opportunity to utilize specific parcel P as part of a broader economic development strategy? So realizing that over the course of time since the announcement and where we are today and where things are moving into the future, what we would be looking at is exploring what are those options for potential reuse. Susan's DEIR had some great concepts. The panel itself has had some ideas and some history attached to it. The Friends of Diablo Canyon has theirs. REACH has theirs. Cal Poly has ideas. There are multiple ideas running around there. I think what the intent is to explore these ideas, the feasibility of some of these ideas, and start to land on those that may be most implementable, most feasible, and aligning with some of the other emerging opportunities that are coming out, such as the consideration of the role of offshore wind and clean energy and other elements to be considered. So this is really grounded in what happens when Diablo closes and those jobs that are very well-paying jobs in the region right now, what happens if those disappear? Is there the potential to take that parcel P specifically and look at opportunities for economic growth and job creation using that infrastructure that's there at Parcel P? So that's a bit of a history and a background, and I recognize that there are so many variables that are attached to this, but really starting to, identify some true conceptual ideas, run through some feasibility scenarios, and start to generate some direction that might be of interest for the region to consider pursuing. Certainly in partnership and consideration with what PG&E's, what their future looks like, as well as the region as a whole and the changes that the region is going through as it relates to some of these additional emerging industry sectors.
Great.
Ms. Seeley, does that provide some insight? And I would certainly turn to Tom and Susan and even Kara for that matter. And Scott, you all have been there from the beginning. You may have something that you'd like to add to that.
This is Seeley, and I appreciate what you just, that clarification. Thank you.
Thank you. Linda, does that answer your or address your question? Thank you. Kara? And then Dave.
Yeah, I wanted to provide just a little bit of background information that might be of interest. In 2022, SB 846 was passed, and that is the bill that extended Diablo's license or ability to potentially extend its operations until 2030, which is a 5-year extension. And that's the only extension that has been authorized by the legislature to date. Many things were required under SB 846, and one of them was that the California Natural Resources Agency had to prepare a report. It was called the Diablo Canyon Power Plant Conservation and Economic Development Plan. And so last year, the Natural Resources Agency came to town, they had a public process, and they in fact developed this plan, which talked about not only Parcel P, but also the 12,000 acres of Diablo Canyon lands that surround it. In that plan, they came up with 5 conclusions, what they called values. Value 1 was conservation and of the ecological and cultural resources on the 12,000 acres. That means North Ranch, South Ranch, and Wild Cherry Canyon. Value 2 was tribal ownership of North Ranch and South Ranch. Value 3 was managed public access on the Diablo Canyon lands, including potential coastal trail extensions. Value 4 was enabling the reuse of Parcel P, and Value 5 was state parks ownership of that last piece of the Diablo Canyon lands, Wild Cherry Canyon. So of those 5 values, what we're talking about today is value number 4, the potential reuse of Parcel P. And in fact, last year's budget included a $5 million allocation for GOPIS to do the project that Dana has described well here today. The other values, 1, 2, 3, and 5, are the subject of a separate $5 million allocation that went to a different state agency, the California Coastal Conservancy. And if you recall, last September, we had agency representatives from the Coastal Conservancy, and they talked about their work under their $5 million allocation. And that includes drafting conservation easements that would cover all 12,000 acres, not counting Parcel P, preparing maps for potential coastal trail locations, conducting public and tribal outreach, and also completing the pre-acquisition tasks for the acquisition of Wild Cherry Canyon, like doing a title report, an environmental site assessment, and some appraisals. Fortunately, what Dana says is true is what I'm hearing, too, from Sacramento, is that these both $5 million, one that went to GoBiz and the $5 million that went to Coastal Conservancy, seem to have survived the latest budget crisis because I think they were allocated last year. So both of these projects will move forward. In the case of the State Coastal Conservancy's $5 million allocation, they already issued an RFQ. They already had 3 different contracts be submitted, and I think they've conducted some tribal outreach on those projects and contracts that have been, those bids that have been made, and probably within the next month or so, we will probably know what contractor has been selected to do that piece, which is, again, the Diablo Canyon lands. This piece is a little bit different schedule, but thanks, Dana, for describing that. Thanks.
Yeah. And Kara, if I could add to that, if I could just add to Kara, and I appreciate that, CNRA drafted that report back to the state legislature in consultation with GoBiz also. we provided additional content that went into that study that was delivered last summer to the legislation or to the legislature. So we've been because of SB 846, we have been connected with CNRA, and we have regular check-ins with them also, tracking kind of these two parallel processes, one a little farther along than the other, but we are hoping to catch up and get our work underway shortly.
Thank you. Thank you, Dana. Dave, you had a question.
I know we're running a little late, so I'll try to keep it really quick. My question started out as a new guy question, which was basically, what are you doing with all this? And it's been quite mostly answered now by your answer to Celie's question. And then, Kara, that's really helpful what you just described there. So the RFP that you're putting out, is that to spend the $5 million, or is it to a contract to hire a consultant to figure out how to spend the $5 million? And so I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, great question. The $5 million is intended to support the study, the potential reuse study, which would include contracting with consultant outside sources to come in and assist with drafting that and doing some research and due diligence on potential reuse. So, yes, it's retaining the services of outside consultants and, expenditures on potential research needs that would go into this as well. So,
You're mostly looking at the issue of job replacement and not looking at the tax-based replacement?
That is certainly a factor and a consideration, but primarily on the job creation and industry sector growth opportunity.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions of Deanna? Well, thank you, Deanna. We can get back on the road, and we really, really appreciate your taking the time to stop on your travels and participate in the meeting.
No, thank you for the time, and I appreciate you allowing me to get back on the road, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have following tonight's wrap-up of the meeting. And if you need to get a hold of me, Susan and Kara have my contact information, as do you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, and safe travels.
Thanks.
Okay, we've come to our public comment portion of the meeting. So first we'll have the folks here in the room who'd like to comment to come up to this microphone, and you have 3 minutes to make a comment. We ask you to stay on focus and on topic, and we'll give you a 30-second warning before your 3 minutes are up. So how many folks here would like to comment? Come on up. And how many do we have online? We have 4 online right now. So if anyone online would like to comment, please raise your hand on the Zoom system. Go ahead, sir. I forgot to say, when you do comment, please state your name, your residence, any affiliation you might have if you're speaking for an organization or a group, and also for the help of our court reporter, would you please spell your name?
Randy Kenney, RANDYKENNEY, native of Atascadero. I'm the second generation with 3 more behind me. I don't have any specific affiliation with anybody. I have worked at Diablo Canyon since 2000, mainly doing the refueling outages. And from way back then, there's always been this vision or rumor or whatever that when Diablo closes, it's going back to natural turf and just how Mother Nature left it or made it to begin with, or as close as they could. And that's the reason that I came, because I was going to ask about this repurposing. And that place has so many opportunities for different types of things. And I do have a couple of questions, one to Scott. I think you mentioned earlier about some demolition being taken place prior to possible future work. Do you know what that demolition consists of and or what buildings are going to be demoed, or did I misread it?
I don't think I spoke anything this evening about demolition. So
oh, okay. I thought you did. I probably missed this because I came a little bit late, but was there talk about the administration building, what they were planning on repurposing that for? Any idea? I mean, I realize that this thing is very, very vague at this point in time, and who knows what's going to happen in hopefully 25 years. So
I'll speak to that a little bit, just real quick, and let you know that I'm very grateful that you're here tonight, and that's exactly the type of input that we're looking for. People that are questioning that, there's opportunities on the website and through our future meetings and workshops to continue to potentially have some input and participate in what that future is. Right now, nothing is certain and nobody knows what anything's going to be, but that's what this is all about, is trying to get together what the community wants and to be able to put, you know, have some input on that as to what Diablo may do with that in the future. So thank you for being here.
And just to tag on, you didn't miss anything about disposition of the administration building.
Okay.
Tonight.
Thank you for allowing me to be here. And like I say, I don't know if you people have had the opportunity to actually be at the plant, be in the plant, see the plant, but it's a wonderful piece of machinery that even me, as a 50-something year tradesman, I just get in some of those areas and I just look around and I see pipe fitting, I see electrical, I see communication, I see ironwork, I see drains, and it's just an amazing, and what really is amazing is that place was built with a slide rule and a pencil long before all these overlays and all of that stuff came out. So thank you very much for my time. I got 13 seconds left I give you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Our next speaker, please. And just a matter of protocol, we will try to answer any questions after the speaker speaks, and potentially, if there are complex questions, after all the speakers have an opportunity to speak, we'll discuss that.
Good evening. Name is Jonathan Duran, Jonathan Duran. I am a representative with the Western States Regional Council of Carpenters, Local 805. That covers the Ventura, Santa Barbara, San Obispo area. For us as a tradesman, Diablo has been a great place to find work. Recently, we just had one of the shutdowns. We had about 60 carpenters out there, millwrights, and as I said, other trades out there. The one thing that, as I was listening to you guys speak about this, is opportunity for repurpose the property. That's great. That's fine. But also include the people that are actually going to build those facilities out there. Include skilled and trained workforce. Include accredited apprenticeship programs. Include a livable wage. Because we all know here in San Luis Obispo County, Santa Barbara County, Ventura County, it's expensive. And being a tradesman, it's a good living. And it's an opportunity for us to be able to have the middle class and have an opportunity to provide for our families out there. Roughly in the area of area that I represent is about 2,000 members, and great opportunity. And as we come through this opportunity for this project, and like I said, we're looking at offshore wind, we're looking at the Vista storage battery, and we're looking at all these other opportunities to be able to provide work for our members within this counties, and looking at the next generation of carpenters. So as we're doing that, we're also trying to include, opportunities for students that are going to be going not to a four-year university, but to another four-year university, and that's trade in the trades, and have an opportunity to be able to work with your hands. Have opportunities for second-chance individuals, women, people that are coming out of being incarcerated, And those allow people to go and be able to live within the county and go back and put the money back into the area that we live. Again, I've been out at Diablo. It's a phenomenal facility. It's very, very unique to be able to go out there and look at that facility, and it's kind of like tucked away up in those hills. But at the end of the day, what we're looking for is just opportunity to be able to have a conversation with GoBiz and have the players here and be able to kind of go, hey, think about the individuals that are going to be building these facilities that if it does be turned off, hey, we're the ones that are going to be there being able to build those new facilities, those new trails, or whatever it might be. But include the trades, include especially us, the carpenters. And but again, thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker. If there's any other speakers here in the audience, please queue up. Go ahead, sir.
All right. My name is Ben Brown, B-E-N-B-R-O-W-N, trying to make it as easy as possible for the court reporter. I live out on O'Connor Way, west of San Luis Obispo, on a family ranch. I'm also the president and co-founder of a small energy storage startup. And I wanted to speak towards some of the planning to potentially reuse the space as a clean energy hub and a place for innovation and clean energy. I think that would be tremendously beneficial for the county as a whole. This county is becoming an epicenter for clean energy between the offshore wind, the Carrizo Plain solar panel plants, and various storage facilities that have been mooted in Morro Bay, off Hollister Peak, and the Whale Rock Pump Storage Hydro. It'd be really nice if this county got to benefit from the innovations in clean energy and the good jobs that came with that, in addition to just being the site of industrial-scale facilities for clean energy. I think it would be lovely to build on the history of Diablo Canyon and the power and the good jobs here by us also becoming a center of innovation. So I hope that the reuse plans that involve the clean energy parks and research are considered very heavily. Alternatively, it would be lovely to see that land preserved as natural and open space, being some of the last undisturbed natural space on this coast. I'm speaking on behalf of myself and my family who have loved and lived in San Luis for much of their lives. Thank you for your time and your service.
Thank you, sir. I think that's all the speakers we have here in the room. We have two online speakers with their hand up. Our first is Marley Brown. And followed by Ryan Pickering. Is it Marley?
Marty.
Oh. Go ahead, Mr. Brown. Go ahead, Marty.
I'm Marty Brown, and I've lived in Itasca, M-A-R-T-Y-B-R-O-W-N, and I've lived in Atascadero since 1972. And I was concerned about the safety aspects of Diablo Canyon with the earthquake risks and the evacuation plans if necessary. I have a comment and a question to make. My comment is the redevelopment of Parcel P plans after decommissioning are very exciting and will serve our county well. A lot to look forward to. And my question is, if PG&E is successful in getting Diablo Canyon's operating license extended to 20 years, that will add significantly to the high-level nuclear waste on site. Would that affect the repurposing of Parcel P? That is my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Marty. We'll have the opportunity to discuss that after our public comments. So the next speaker is Ryan Pickering. Ryan, are you with us?
Yes, thank you.
Great. Ryan, please go ahead.
My name is Ryan Pickering, and I'm an energy policy researcher in Berkeley, California. I've been following the evolution of Diablo Lands and the plan for repurposing, and I want to continue to bring stakeholder attention to the tribal land transfer policy and the application from Yaqtichu Tichu Yaqtilhini tribe And my question for the group is, what are we doing to continue to center tribal agency as plans for the extension of the plant continue? And does a plan to continue operations change the dynamic in which the land could be repurposed back to the tribe? Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. Our next speaker is Mona Tucker. Mona?
Good evening, everyone. My name is Mona Tucker, M-O-N-A-T-U-C-K-E-R. I'm the tribal chair for Yaktichu Teacher Yaktahini, Northern Chumash Tribe of San Luis Obispo County and Region. And we everything that happens at Diablo Lands is a special interest to our tribe, as this is land that was stolen from us. It was taken. We were removed violently from there. There was no compensation or agreement. I do have a question tonight about the offshore substations. Will there be three offshore substations? And then regarding the onshore substations, it appears there will be three. Will they run along the coastline, say, from north to south, taking up a lot of the, destroying a lot of the coastline area? Thank you.
Thank you, Mona. Do we have any other members of the public that would like to make a comment online? Please raise your hand. Yes, we have, and we're struggling with the first name, but the last name is Cans.
I got it.
Are you there? Seychelles Cans, we can't hear you. If you're speaking, maybe you need to unmute your mic. So we still can't hear you. Please try to unmute your mic. Nope, we're not able to hear you. I really apologize. If you would, you can make a written comment to the panel. All the panel members will receive it, and it will become part of the public record by going to DiabloCanyonPanel.org and clicking Make Comment in the upper right-hand corner. So we apologize for the technical problem. Any other members online that would like to make a comment? Corey Walsh, unmute your mic and you can start speaking. Corey? So, just hold on just a minute. Can you please unmute your mic? See if that's a problem.
No, this is Corey Walsh. I didn't have any questions. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Looks like that's... Anthony Fresco. Go ahead and speak, please. Anthony Fresco? We can't hear you. Do we have a tech problem? Go ahead and maybe unmute your mic.
Can you hear me now?
There we are. We can hear you.
Yeah, my background is I used to work
for... Anthony, you must have two sources on. If you're listening on your phone and your computer, please turn one of them off.
Yeah. I've been trying to figure out how to do that.
Anthony, all we're hearing is a huge echo. We apologize, but please turn one of your electronic devices off or on mute.
Is that better?
Yes. Oh. No, unfortunately not.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. Forget it then. Sorry.
I apologize. This isn't working. We can't hear you. All we hear is an echo once you start talking. So we're going to ask you to also go to the website, DiabloCanyonPanel.org, and please click comment in the upper right-hand corner and submit a written comment. Sorry for the technical difficulties. Anyone else raise their hand? Okay, that ends our public comment period. All the public comments will become part of the record, and you can view those comments after the transcript is completed in about 3 weeks on the panel website. Panel, there were a number of issues or questions that were raised during the public comment. Does any of the panel members want to address those questions or have any questions or comments of their own? Bruce, and then Kara.
Yes, I wanted to respond to Mona Tucker's comment as well as Ryan Pickering, and I just think that there's a great deal of sensitivity on the panel. I can't speak for everybody, but I've certainly heard a lot of the discussion around respect for what tribal leadership wants to do with the land, and I think everybody really desires outcomes where the YTT is given a great deal of jurisdictional say in what happens to the preservation of the lands. And I know from I'd say Mona Tucker is now a friend. We've worked on some projects together. And I have nothing but confidence in the integrity of her views regarding preservation of the land and having minimal impact on it. So I don't know the answer to the question about the substation impacts, but I think the answer you would get from technical people, and if there are any still on the line, I would invite them to jump in, is that it's going to depend on the design, but one would hope that the offshore substations would not be, you know, 20 feet offshore, and that they would be appropriately located, and that anything that's onshore would land at Parcel P or elsewhere and not on the open lands that I think most people feel should be preserved in a way that is sensitive to that purpose. And also to, I wanted to acknowledge what you said about, what Mona said about the land being stolen without compensation. And I think that's something that everybody in this room should remember. And if we knew the details of those stories and the cries of the people as they're being, you know, ripped away from their historic communities, one can only imagine the anguish that occurred in that historical context. And we should be sensitive to what tribal leadership wants to do with this land. And that's my opinion, and I think many people here would share that opinion. Scott, is, I think, plays a very central role here, and everybody here really respects what he has to say. And he's a tribal leader in Mona Tucker's cousin, so comes to all the meetings, and I think he knows there's an open line. Anybody he wants to call, we're all willing to listen. So I just wanted to address those two questions that came up.
Thank you. We have Kara, and then we have Scott Billington has his hand up and may have an answer to one of the substation questions. And then Francis Romero, one of the panel members, also wants to make a comment, and then Scott. So, Kara?
I wanted to respond to Jonathan Durant. Thank you for your comments. The biggest job that will be associated with Parcel P may end up being decommissioning the plant itself. We don't know when that'll occur. Maybe it will be in 2030, but we know it's a decade-long project plus involving thousands of jobs. And we have spoken to this in the strategic vision for the panel, which is on our website, JabbleCanyonPanel.org. And if you look through that document, you'll see that we prioritize the hiring of local people to do that decommissioning work, as well as project labor agreements. So I just wanted to mention that we agree with what you're saying. And then secondly, for Ben Brown, I just wanted to mention that Local Economic Development Group REACH has prepared sort of the basic outlines for the green tech innovative proposals that you mentioned you envision for Parcel P. And you may want to check out their website and see what they've said, because I think you and REACH's view of the world are very much in sync. And in fact, with the community too, because that REACH plan was prepared in consultation with Cal Poly, a lot of environmental groups, trade groups, et cetera. So I think what you're thinking is in sync with what the community is as well. Thanks.
Thank you, Kara. Jeff Billington, and then Francis Romero, and then Scott Lathrop.
Yeah, I'll just be brief and just kind of respond to the comment if you appreciate it. There will be floating substations out by the offshore wind farms. So those will be out by where those collars are designated, approximately 20 miles offshore. And then there will be a need, as I indicated, for substations, and they will depend upon the technology that each of the developers use when it comes on land, and then to bring it to the system substation. So the comment was correct. There would be three, and they'll be floating, but they'll be out by where the wind farms are as collectors, and then basically a transition depending upon the technology onshore from each of the wind farms and then to the transmission infrastructure like the Diablo substation. So I hope that helps.
Thank you, Jeff. Francis Romero, one of our panel members who's participating remotely. Francis? Francis, we can't hear you. Is your mic on mute?
My bad. Chuck, thank you so much. I just wanted to take the opportunity to say thank you to each and every person who has taken the time out to participate, both the members of the public and the presenters. And I just wanted to quickly echo that I agree with Bruce Severance. Mona, I've got to say that there are many of us who have the same view that you do. And we really do appreciate Scott. I'd also like to point out that given the wind timelines, my day job, I'm a land use consultant. I've worked doing coastal commission permitting, county permitting, city permitting, entitlements, and a variety of things over the last 25 years. The timelines that we're currently looking at for wind, there's no imminent danger that anything's coming online really soon. So I am supportive of PG&E's efforts to extend their licensing, because we certainly don't want any gaps in energy production or provision, and that a lot of the technology, the green technologies, either don't exist yet or they haven't been perfected yet because they've not actually been implemented. It's not as though day one everything's going to work great. I'm
I grew up with the space program. My dad worked for Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and there are a lot of starts and stops when you're dealing with new technology. So I know everybody's anxious, but I think we all have to temper that with some patience. And just look forward to the next meeting. There's going to be a lot of ground to cover, a lot of discussions, and just want to thank everybody for their time.
Thank you, Francis. Scott.
Yes, I would just like to maybe drill down a little bit more about a Parcel P in general as far as a receiving site for substations. My understanding is that the county zoning, of course, would allow that to happen, and the surrounding properties of Parcel P are not zoned for such a thing. If it winds up being that through all the analysis that they cannot put, I want to say, those substations on Parcel P, I would assume the county's not thinking about a rezoning of the other properties to allow a station to go into place. I would assume they would go to one of the options and put everything into Morro Bay and then try to do a transmission line over to, I want to say, Diablo. So I'm just concerned about potentially substations winding anywhere else on the Pecho Coast other than Parcel P. So I don't know if, Susan, you're still around, but I don't know if there's been any discussion of that out there.
Hi. No, it's a good question, Scott. There hasn't been discussion. We just recently, I think, got our arms around the fact that there are these additional substations that are going to be required, and I think what we need to do is just see where the leaseholders apply, and we'll have to go from there. But I understand your concern about going beyond what the land is zoned for those substations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Scott. Next comment, Seeley.
Thank you. this is a question for Jeff. There is a lot of public, what would I call it, opposition, I guess, to building offshore wind here. And excuse me, I don't know enough about it to be able to make, you know, a judgment about it. But some of the concerns that I've heard from other people is about high-frequency ultrasonic testing being done from boats to scope out the area, and that testing is very harmful to aquatic life. And I'm just wondering if, number one, if that's part of it, of the scoping, and I won't ask about the other part. Just is that part of the plan?
Is that a question for Jeff?
Yeah, it's Jeff here. I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer in terms of when you're looking at kind of the environmental or the as they're doing their siting. That would be probably, unfortunately, if Matthew was still on from Bohm, something that would be from for a question. So if you have a question that way, I'd probably
sorry, I was confused. I meant Matthew.
Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, you wouldn't know that. Okay, thank you.
Matt, and then we have a question from Tom. Is Matt still on the line? He may be gone. So I don't think he's with us anymore. Tom, you have a question or comment.
Tom. Yeah, comment. Just going back to Scott Lathrop's comment about zoning change. Scott, zoning change might not be required in other areas to still accept electrical infrastructure. So the team's taking a look up right now, and we'll confer with Susan, but there are allowable uses under the land use ordinance for different activities given a certain jurisdiction. a certain zoning determination. And, you know, we have substations in ag that is on land across the county and across many counties. So I don't want the panel to think that just because something's zoned differently than parcel P, that it might not be an allowable use already. The county has public information on that. We're taking a look up on the room right now to see if we can grab it real quick, but we'll follow up with the county and answer that back to the panel.
Thanks for
Tom. Go ahead, Bruce.
Tom, would you elaborate on, you know, responding to Mona Tucker's concern and Scott's concern as well regarding whether or not substations would start punctuating the landscape in what would be preserved lands? That would happen?
Well, I think what we've heard from the experts is it's a physical requirement of the systems. But what we don't have are designs, and none have been presented to PG&E, and none have presented by regulators, and it doesn't have to be at one location. You saw different layouts of how things could make landing, but what we did here, the technologies might influence it. I think Dave got at a question too that we don't know that it's scalable, so we don't have a really good thumbnail sketch or a rule of thumb of what the impacts could be at this point.
That sounds very open-ended. Is there, could you make
it's intended because we're not the developers and we don't design it. So that's,
right. Yeah.
They'll
be speaking to PG&E at some point. So you've got a mental note on what their sensitivities are where that's concerned. And I appreciate your making a note of that.
Okay. Thank you, Bruce. We have a comment from Dave and then the last question or comments from Kara. Dave?
Yeah, there was a question that came up from the public comment. I don't recall exactly who it was, but it was about the continued operation of Diablo Canyon. If it goes on for another 20 years, to what extent would the storage of the high-level waste in the casks preclude the development scenarios that we're all kind of excited about? And I think I know this is a question for Tom, I believe, but I think I assume the answer is, well, the ISFIC is there either way. There's capacity to handle continued operation, so I don't think it's that much of a factor. Would you agree with that, Tom?
Yeah, with a couple qualifications. So, yes, we do see co-use as occurring. We anticipate fuel storage will be there. And if you think about the site's characteristics, the upper plateau is over 300 feet in elevation and very different from the areas that are principally sought after for repurposing, which is the power plant bluff, the 85-foot elevation, the marina, and some of those parking lots that vary between where our fire station is around 120 foot of elevation all the way down to the marina. Those areas don't interact with one another, and we're going to be putting our video back online. We have to update some wording on it because it talks about us closing in 2025. But the video shows ISFACs around dry cask storage facilities around the United States and their proximity to communities and public access, and they're not incongruous. Our Humboldt Bay facility, the dry cask storage facility, has a public trail 51 feet away from it. And then San Onofre is one of the stronger examples. It's one of the busiest state parks with 1.5 million visitors a year, and visitors are adjacent to that facility. So certainly something that future occupants will be aware of, but our location with the gradient separation from 85 to 300 feet, and we look at traffic circulation, think embassy-style gates so someone couldn't go up the hill. That's how we would shrink. I think Susan's slide also tonight, if you revisit that slide deck, showed those same elevations. Because we're not just going to be in the dry cask storage business, potentially the water business, but they'll have the transmission and all that infrastructure is at that upper elevation.
Okay, thanks. And thank then you, we're getting near the end here, so just a comment of appreciation for this process. This is my first meeting being part of you guys, and the panel and the public and the comments and the experts. This is a great process, and I'm really pleased to be a part of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Kara, for our last comment or question, then we have to move on if you want to adjourn on time.
Thank you. Just a quick comment. There's been discussions about potential onshore substation activity beyond Parcel P, maybe even on the Diablo Canyon lands. But I want to refer to what we talked about early, which is the California Natural Resources Agency and GoBiz put together this conservation and economic development plan, and part of that specifically states conservation of the 12,000 acres, which is North Ranch, South Ranch, and Wild Cherry Canyon. And in fact, the Coastal Conservancy is on the eve of preparing conservation easements across those lands, and I'm pretty sure they would include restrictions on future industrialized uses. So maybe the zoning would be more flexible for those substations that we're envisioning now, but the conservation easements may not be so flexible. Thanks.
Thank you. Let's move on in the agenda. And our last item is discussion of upcoming panel meetings. Dina Bellman.
Sure, thanks. So again, my thanks to everyone who's here and sticking it out with us tonight. Thank you so much for your participation, and we really appreciate your comments and questions. We take them to heart. We appreciate you online. We appreciate you here in the facility with us today. We look forward to seeing you at these future meetings. This summer, we're going to be looking at long-term spent fuel management. In the fall, we're going to have a status report on safety issues that were raised by some community members. And this winter, we will be looking towards the Diablo Canyon final environmental impact report. So that's what we kind of have on deck for the rest of our year, and we hope that you all are here with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Dina. Bruce, I'll turn it back to you to close the meeting.
Yeah, I assume there's no other closing comments from members. Yeah, thank you. I wanted to thank all the members of the public for participating in person and online, the speakers for giving us their time and the value of their expertise. I want to thank the City of Atascadero for giving us the venue this evening and all the facility support that has come with that. The Atascadero Police Department for providing security. The PG&E Diablo Canyon Emergency Response Unit for medical emergency support. PG&E's meeting support team, the Independent Living Resource Center for hearing interpretation, AGP Video for managing the Zoom meeting and video recording, and Lexitas Reporting for court reporting and preparing the meeting transcript. I also want to remind the public that comments can be given to directly to the Diablo Canyon panel at diablocanyonpanel.org, and video recordings and written transcripts with meeting slides will be available on the panel website should you want to refer to them in the future. Thank you very much.